Okay, I won't spend too much time because we've talked at length about the inverse problem this morning, and what I do largely follows what other people have done, and especially Greg Newman. We both do nonlinear conjugate gradient inversions, but basically the inverse problem is defined by this equation where you have some data and you're trying to fit a model into that data, and this f is your forward modeling functional, which takes the model and transforms it to data space, and then plus some observational error. And this looks very familiar. It's a standard Tikhonov type objective function, and just sort of in its simplest form, but this m can be just a regular m or an m minus m zero. And in our code, we have lots of knobs and things that you can do to the smoothing. It's not just a standard Laplacian. You can put tears in it. You can have a reference model of different weights and different directions. So as Doug mentioned, you know, it helps you to build in any a priori information that you might have. Okay, let me just say for the observed data that we that I like to invert is I sort of have a hybrid, and I like, even though we look at all the impedance elements, I like logarithms. Okay, I always am biased by logarithms. I like log of resistivity in my model. I like log of impedance. I mean, because that's what we look at. The real data we look at, apparent resistivity in phase. We look at log of apparent resistivity in phase, which is like a log of an impedance. So I like to use that because it's as close to the data that we're actually looking at. So I invert the real and imaginary of zxx and zyy, because those don't have the nice phase characteristics that the anti-diagonals have. But I invert log of zxy and log of zyx, because that, when you take log of a complex number, that has a very nice split into log of the amplitude and phase, which is basically what we look at for real data. And it just seems to work well. Okay, I know that's sort of ad hoc, but I've tried different things, and that just seems to work well. Okay, our V, so you try to fit the data, and so we have these data at each frequency. You can optionally have vertical magnetic transfer function, and then we just weight each data by its some estimate of the what we think the data should be, and similarly to what other people do. So it's a little different, but we look at the amplitude of a row of the impedance, because we think that, because I think that's sort of like the electric field, and so I take like whatever 2 or 5% of the amplitude of a row, so the amplitude of zxx plus zxy, and then I apply that as a minimum, is the floor on either of the elements, and that prevents the inversion from spending too much time trying to fit very small, ill-determined values of your data. Okay, is that clear? Okay, nonlinear conjugate gradients. We saw this before. One of the critical things about this, if you don't have a good preconditioner, you'll never get anywhere, especially with these problems. And line minimization, so let me just move on. So in our algorithm, the line minimization, you know, if you just go and pull out a subroutine out of a numerical recipes book for doing a line search, they like to do lots of forward problems to really nail down where you are on the curve. But we're trying to get away with doing as few forward problems as we can because they're expensive. So our line minimization, we just use a very simple, our first guess is like the Gauss-Newton, it's a one-dimensional Gauss-Newton step, and that seems to work pretty well. And if it's not very good, then we'll do one more and you know, use some rules of bisection and so forth. Like everyone else, our operations with the sensitivity matrix are computed efficiently, so they require one additional forward problem per frequency. So the whole idea idea is computational parsimony, reduce the number of board problems. I said the preconditioner was very important, so for the efficiency of these algorithms, so we use something which approximates the Hessian of the objective function, where we have our L transpose L, and we have an approximation to the diagonal part of the data part of the Hessian. And this is very similar to what Gray, they use that in their code. And, we use something very similar to that.
What's A?
A is a sensitivity matrix. So we approximate the diagonal part of the sensitivity matrix using like approximate sensitivities, like Colin has worked on and published a nice paper on. Yeah, in the early versions of our 2D code, we just used a scalar times as a diagonal, and that seemed to work fairly well for most problems. But we found some problems where that didn't work well, and so that's and in 3D it wasn't as good as it worked in 2D. So it motivated us to find something that would do a little bit better. And by doing this, by adding that, that adds some more information. If it approximates a Hessian, that's sort of like almost like a Gauss-Newton update. Not quite.
Have you ever observed that sometimes that this precondition can activate parts of your model space where you really don't have a lot of sensitivity?
No. We always add a little damping to this, and it seems to work pretty well.
Because you have only gradients, right? But this is sensitivity, A is sensitivities. So you're doing some nice.
An approximate sensitivity, like Colin wrote
so
about that.
I didn't work,
yeah. Okay, so just jump right into the Ford model, the Dublin Ford model. This model didn't give a lot of anomaly. So this is just a map of the XY phase at 30 seconds, just to kind of get a quick overview of what's going on. You can see the conductor here, but there's really not much response from the resistor. And this is just the YX. Okay, so I'm just going to show a couple cross sections right over the profile of 1 and 2. So it's a very similar picture to what Sasaki showed. The model grid is finely discretized. I can't remember the exact dimensions, 93 by 93 by 70 or something. uniform gridding within this area. It's kind of hard to see. You do see, if you looked on the computer screen, can you see that? Does it look purple?
Yeah.
Sort of purple. You get some hint of the resistor, but it's not a big response.
What's the scale on that?
I'm sorry, it goes from about 10 ohmmeters at the warmest color to 200 ohmmeters. At the purple is anything purple is 200 and above, but it doesn't go much beyond 200 ohmmeters. And then that's the other profile over the other conductor, and you know, with the smooth model inversion, you can't get that sharp bend. You sort of get this kind of an effect.
I'm surprised you're not getting any more definition of the conductor to the right.
I think because this one here that comes close to the surface really dominates the response. But you know, who knows if you try to really drive it down.
What sort of fix do you get? I mean, did you have noise? I'm not sure.
I did several runs, some by adding some random Gaussian noise, some without. For this model, it didn't really change the results very much. When I add random percent, I try to, you know, I can easily go down and fit it to a normalized chi-square of 1, which I know that's a global measure of MISCA, but at least it gives you some idea about whether you're feeding your data on average within the standard deviation. And I think I added, for this I used 2% error floors, which is I think lower than we typically would use, but I knew it was synthetic data. So I don't know if there's any, I can stop there, or we can look at, you know, slices. I don't know if that would be useful or not, or the data fits or not. Oh yeah, thank you. For this one, I actually inverted the tipper too. So it was, and I didn't do one with just the impedance. I just didn't even think about it. I just used all the data at all the frequencies at all the sites. So is that good for this, or does
I'm just thinking
see?
About the nature of the model. I mean, the quasi-ITE mode is going to be the current flowing in and out the board, and that's what I dominantly see.
Yep.
The quasi-ITM is the one that's going to get you the charges on the boundaries. So I'm just wondering whether your Z, Y, X in my coordinate system, not Greg's, with X going in and out the board, whether your Z, Y, X is not... It's only stations above that boundary.
Mm-hmm. We could, if you want, we could actually look at data sets.
Yeah,
no. So, I guess
we have some questions. I want to listen to about the quantum balloon,
the
value of the resistivity.
What's the value of resistivity?
How about the
This is about 100. It's about the background resistivity. Yeah, the blues is about 100. The blue is about 100. Okay, so sorry, just stop it there then. And does anyone want to look at that or not?
Yeah.
Okay. Can we just hook in to this one? Let's just plug it in. I think I've done this with, I've done it elsewhere, so I think it. So here we'll just we'll look at horizontal slices and we'll just go down.
What program is this, Randy?
This Winglink. This, you know, if you want a really good commercial package for MT data analysis, this is Winglink, and it's an exceptional package. Okay, so if you look at the top, you can see the depths z equals 1 from. Give you this depth. So I'll just kind of go down, and if anyone wants me to stop, you can just holler. So we don't get anything until of course that's an extra module. It's a up there, can were starting to see that long conductor, but then didn't go deeper. It's, and you do see the resistor sort of weakly coming in, but it's not a, like I said, it's not a big response.
How many iterations did you run the algorithm in?
This was run 40 or 50 iterations to get to here. So is that good for looking at the model? I'll just look at a couple of data bits real quick. For this run, I guess I just did half the frequencies. I found for this model it didn't make much difference whether I used half the frequencies or all the frequencies. So
like every second frequency?
So this one I used every second frequency, but I did do runs with all the frequencies, and I found for this model it really didn't make much difference. In real field data, I find it does make a difference to use more frequencies. Okay, so let me. Does anyone have another site in particular they'd like to see? That's not interesting.
You said that was in.
Yeah, that is easy.
Do you have any of the diagonal components?
No, not so easy to. I can't show it on here, but.
What package is that? This is quite nice.
I just dumped all the data in it and ran the inversion. Okay. Here we go. N00. See, this is why you should. You know, this has a pretty good vertical magnetic transfer function as well, and it's a lot of useful information there. Let's see how well we did to fit that. Okay. I set an error for 0.01 for the vertical magnetic transfer function, but anyway. So.
Yeah, there's an error. There's an example of vertical field, how the error has been distributed all over the data space, and so that strong structure is underfit.
Well, that's right. That's because I just said an error floor 0.01 without even looking at the data. You know, you should always look at the data before you do it, and you would have got a sense that you should have used a lower, the even smaller absolute error floor for the vertical magnetic transfer function.
Yeah, but the one at 10 seconds, for example, it is 2.5 sigma long, because it's 0.05 compared to 0.025. So
right, and then you overfit it someplace else. Yep.
Can you tell us to what accuracy number is in terms of distributing?
I used 2%, an equivalent of 2% in apparent resistivity, and then the appropriate whatever that turns out to be. I tend to use. I set an absolute error floor of 0.01, and then what was the? I can't remember what. I think I used 2%, and then an absolute error floor of 0.01. So, I should have probably reduced that error floor for this data.